From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
When it comes to signal strength, Joel, everybody is obsessed with their receive signal meters on their transceivers, you know. Everyone is so proud to say, hey, I was 10 dB over S9, or reverse, oh, he was only 2 S units, you know, and so on and so forth. But really, what is an S unit? And is it the same everywhere?
Well, that's one of the problems with S units, is that they typically aren't.
No.
It was an attempt to make a formalization of the original amateur RST system for signal reports. That was used for many years, still used. The R was for readability and went from 1 to 5. S was for signal strength from S1 to S9. And T for tone, which is a CW-only issue, mainly indicating how much power supply hum was being transmitted, which was an issue with early transmitters, which didn't have good filtering in the power supplies, or sometimes didn't have any filtering in the power supplies. Some of the early transmitters used self-rectifying amplifiers, for example, which had just AC applied to the plates. Lots of hum. But focusing on the signal strength, the definitions, S1 is meant faint signals, barely perceptible, to S9, extremely strong signals. And these had no particular reference. If you search the ARL website for RST, you will come up with quick reference aids that includes the early RST definitions, as well as a bunch of useful information all hams should have nearby. That used to be commonly put under a glass surface on your desk so you could read it when you were working to check on what level signal you should report to somebody. During the period between World War I and World War II, and I'm not sure exactly when since I didn't spend a lot of time looking at such things during that period, it became popular for shortwave receivers to include a signal strength meter. This could be used as a tuning aid, or it could be used to adjust rotary antennas for maximum received signal, or to allow comparisons between received stations' signal strength. Unfortunately, they were generally driven by the receiver's automatic gain control, or AGC voltage, which was just available in AM mode in the early receivers. But that was still usable. You could switch the BFO off and the AVC on and turn the RF gain up, and you could take a reading on somebody's CW signal, even though you couldn't hear him while you were doing that too well. The scales were not particularly standardized, although after World War II, when I started getting into this thing, they tended to go either from 0 to 9 or 1 to 9, just because, I guess. But there was no particular meaning to the numbers, except you could look at them and say, well, this guy's reading 8 and this guy's reading 9, so the guy that's reading 9 is probably stronger than the guy who's reading 8. But that's all you could say about it. By the 1930s, it was agreed by some that S9 would correspond to 50 microvolts at the input terminals of the receiver. But this was still not a measure because it didn't reference a particular impedance. Thus, the actual power received would be different depending on the design of the receiver. So that's one kind of issue.
Okay, yeah.
Now, a lot later, Region 1 of the International Amateur Radio Union agreed on a technical recommendation for S-meter calibration for transceivers.
Oh, I didn't know that came out of the IARU.
In 1981.
Huh.
But it was actually based on a definition provided by Collins Radio somewhat earlier. Now, that still defined S9 as 50 microvolts, but it actually defined it as minus 73 dBm, which is 50 microvolts at the 50-ohm input to the receiver. So that defined an actual power level. So now we're on fairly solid ground. The same recommendation defined the difference in signal levels of one S unit as a difference of 6 decibels. Now that's equivalent to a voltage ratio of 2, twice as much voltage at the input terminals, which is the same as a power ratio of 4. Signals stronger than S9 are described by specifying the strength above an S9 signal level, as you mentioned, such as 20 dB or 20 decibels over S9, or simply 20 over 9.
Exactly.
And modern S meters are usually calibrated in that manner, usually with S9 perhaps in the middle of the meter, and then the decibels above shown above that point. Now, this sounds like everything should make perfect sense and should be constant from receiver to receiver, but it doesn't quite work that way. Why is that? Well, if you think about it, if you put 50 microvolts into your antenna terminals, and you should see S9 then. But what happens if you turn the attenuator on or the preamp on or off? You'll notice the S meter will move.
Yes.
Now, that shouldn't be the case because the definition is based on the voltage at the terminals. So that what you do on the receiver should not change the S meter reading.
Yeah, you're right when you think about it, yeah.
Now, the other thing that happened is, as you noted, this was always a big thing for people, and people like to see that S meter swing around rapidly. And so manufacturers got wise to this and said, oh, buy my radio if the S meter moves faster or further than the other guy's radio. So there was kind of an effort to make S meters more sensitive. But of course, what that meant is they no longer had the same significance, had any relationship to the actual definition of S units. They still could be used as tuning indicators and for adjusting antenna directions, but they didn't measure the input signal anymore. That doesn't mean you couldn't take a calibrated signal generator, set the controls in a particular way, such as attenuator off, preamp off, and put 50 microvolts into the antenna terminals from your signal generator and note what the meter says, which it probably wouldn't be S9. But whatever it is, you can make a note and say, and it won't be the same on every band, by the way, and then you drop it down 6 dB and make a note of what the S meter says on that. So you can make your own calibration chart. And then all you have to do, you have to remember to say, if you want to give somebody an accurate reading that they can compare with somebody else's or with you on the next day, you have to remember to turn the RF gain all the way up and turn the attenuator off and turn the preamp off. So you have your settings constant that relate to your personal calibration chart. And then you can make an accurate reading. And you can say, my S meter says you're 40 over 9, but actually by the official definition, you're only S3, or whatever the story is. So that can be done. But recently, and the first company that I was aware of that did this was Elecraft. They had a absolute standard S meter calibration set up in their receiver design. And it was an option. You could take it either way. So if you did that, it said, if it was an S9 signal, it said that whether the attenuator was on or the attenuator was off, or the preamp was on or the preamp was off. I believe Flex Radio also does that. I'm not aware of others that are doing that. But more manufacturers are more aware that people want the S meter to be a meaningful reading and consequently are tending to be more constant in that regard. Many receivers that even though they're more accurately calibrated than they were in the past, they still have this issue that the calibration only works at a particular setting of the controls, and you need to find out what that is to be able to make sensible measurements.
Well, that does make sense. Well, let's take a break for DX Engineering, and we will be back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. And I have a question this time.
Okay.
Why can't all transceivers have a single standard of behavior and calibration for S meter? Why are they all so different?
Well, I think it just traditionally they... Nobody worried about that too much. They all had their own way of doing things and their own design. And only very recently with, software-defined radios that have software running things like the meter,
yes,
had you had the capability to compensate easily for changing control settings. That could be done in other ways, I suppose, but it's pretty tricky. And so it requires, part of the software package that's made for the transceiver to be able to do that. The radios that do it are typically the software-defined radios, and there are others in that category that may do that. I just am not familiar with their design. So you have to have that as one of your objectives when you design the transceiver, and I guess it's not a high on many people's list. The other thing is, it's a little tricky, is there are component tolerances and so forth. So unless you spend time designing it carefully, it's not going to come out exactly right just because of the difference between one integrated circuit and another in the next radio on the production line. So it has to be well thought out, and it has to be an objective of the design process, I guess.
When you hear two guys talking on the air and one guy says, well, your S9 here, and then somebody else breaks in and they say, well, he's S5. Are you saying that all these expressions of S unit measurements are meaningless?
They're not meaningless, but they're not as meaningful as you might hope, usually. I mean, they're meaningful in that if the guy that says you're S5 and somebody else is S7, the chances are the person that they receive as S7 is stronger than the one that's S5. But is it 12 dB stronger as it should be, or is it only 3 or 4 dB? At one point, we did some comparisons of S meters and transceivers, and it was amazing that the S meter indications had different meanings depending on where you were in the scale. So it might be at the very low end of the S meter readings, one S unit was actually 2 dB, whereas up at the top near S9, it was 4 dB, and, you know, where it said 10 over, that 10 was maybe 7 dB, you know, all that kind of thing. So it just varied with that. It varied by band and varied by, as I say, controls. So all of that stuff's going on. You know, there really was no incentive for a long time to do anything about it. And as I say, a lot of people really liked an S meter that was lively. People would buy yes. receivers by, that had lively S meters. Well, okay, but, you know, it's not as meaningful. You know, nobody buys voltmeters that way. You don't want a lively voltmeter.
No, you don't want a lively voltmeter, no. Well, and of course, so many transceivers now, modern rigs, the S meters are not mechanical. They are visual,
yep,
created by the software within the radio. And those can be quite lively.
They can. And, you know, sometimes you can have them hold peaks and do other things, too, that are, you know, again, still, you know, I don't want to knock this too hard. They're still useful as a tuning aid. They're useful to make a comparison. If you have an attenuator, you know, this is something you can do. If you have built-in attenuator in your receiver, and some of them may even go, if they went 6, 12, 18 dB, for example, well, each one of those steps should be one S unit. So you look at the S meter, and you throw in one step of attenuation and see how much it changes. And, you know, most transceivers probably will change more than one S unit. Now, if it happens to be in 10 dB steps, well, that should be, 10 dB should be a little less than two S units. So get a strong, steady signal and, you know, try this experiment. Switch on your attenuator and see what happens to the meter reading. And switch it on the next step and see what happens. And you'll probably find that even though the attenuation may be the same, the amount of change in S units probably isn't, because you're in a different part of the operating range. And it's probably not all that close to what it should be for the attenuator. Or maybe it will be. You could find out. It's very easy to find out with that. The better way is to use a 1 dB precision step attenuator in the antenna lead. But be very careful when you do that, because if you hit the transmit button, they will work as dummy loads, but only for a very short time, where you don't have that problem with the antenna or with the attenuator built into your transceiver.
Well, how about a question?
Okay.
All right. Let's dig up a question. We have one here from Larry, K5LDA, and he's asking, we enjoy camping in our fifth wheel camper and combining it with amateur radio. Can you discuss ideas for effective RV antennas? My main interests are DX and the digital modes. We usually camp at RV parks, and we occasionally meet other hams on our trips, and we always talk about, of course, antennas.
Well, of course.
Yes.
Antennas are a good topic, one of my favorites. And since you mentioned DX, that sounds like you want, as we have discussed many times before, low-angle radiation. And again, depending on what the surrounding terrain is like, that may be an issue. But if you're talking about operation while you're at the RV park as opposed to operation while you're driving, which is probably different antennas, or you can certainly have larger antennas at the RV park than you probably want to have on the road. That's, I guess, my point. And while you're on the road, the usual loaded single-band whip with a resonators work well, or motorized screwdriver-type multi-band antennas can work well. And typically they're attached to the tow vehicle, perhaps just above the bed rail. So that's one kind of thing. But probably when you're parked at an RV park, you have the ability to have somewhat more efficient antennas. Now, horizontal antennas have a number of advantages, including the fact typically you have a 6 dB ground reflection gain at some angle. But for reasonable heights, usually you have a ground reflection gain at angles that are not useful for DX. So you usually need to get up, my rule of thumb is at least a half wavelength above ground for a horizontal antenna. And typically for an inverted V with a single support, you want to be about 1.5 times as high just to get the same effect. Now the higher frequency bands lately, at least, the bands higher than 17 meters in frequency have not been as much use lately, though there's no reason they can't be. They will be from time to time, but they're less likely to be open to interesting places now than they have been in other parts of the sunspot cycles. So that means if you're talking about 20 meters and lower frequencies, you need to be at least 35 feet high. You know, they will work fine. A horizontal antenna that's lower than that will work fine, but just not for long distance propagation as well as a vertical antenna. If it were me, I'd try to rig a vertical trap antenna with a hinged base somehow that can be elevated above the top of the camper. That would be the perfect thing. And if the camper has a metal roof, what you want to do is you want to connect the coax cable for the antenna, of course, the center conductor to the antenna, but the important thing is that the shield of the coax be connected to the roof right by the bottom of the antenna, as close as you can get it. Any distance between them that actually acts like making the antenna longer and it won't be as well tuned. So that's a very important consideration because you can't always attach wires to things. I mean, drilling holes in roofs of campers and other things is not always the best for environmental reasons. You could put the base at an edge, and for most people that would probably be the rear of the camper. What happens with that is you actually get something of a directional antenna, I found with some experiments. You have a preferred direction towards the mass of the car or the vehicle. So if it's at a corner, the best performance will be across the diagonal of the camper top, which is kind of an interesting thing you can take advantage of by parking in a particular orientation if you know, you're going to want to work in the daytime and you want to go...
Or move your camper.
Or you move your camper.
Parts of the world.
Absolutely
and,
right. Yeah. You can do that. You might make your neighbors crazy, but I guess you could also move the antenna to a different corner, which might be even harder. But just keep in mind, it's not a big thing. It's not like you get a great front-to-back ratio, but typically about 2 or 3 dB, which can be significant.
Significant, yeah.
Yeah. So you might as well have it where you want it and then where you don't want it. Now, of course, if you have it in the center of the top of the camper, it'll be fairly omnidirectional, probably preferring the long directions to the short ones. I would guess you'd want some kind of folding or removable gin pole to make the thing be able to be pulled up, and guy wires that can be positioned in such a way that they don't go off the reservation while you're driving. That would be not a good thing. In fact, you want to make sure the whole thing stays on top of your camper while you're driving, but you probably don't want to drive with it up. You probably want to take it down. So I think that would work well, and you also might, being an optimist, I would always have some wire horizontal dipoles at hand, just in case you go someplace with helpful trees that are in the right place and you have something, get a halyard over the trees. There's no reason not to use them as well, if you can. But it's nice, I would think, to be self-sufficient. And most camper parks I've seen tend to have the trees at the edges where you probably aren't. So,
yes,
to keep in mind.
Well, that would make sense. Excellent advice, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for The Doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.